Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we have with us a friend and colleague of many years. Indeed, I believe he was the first guest of this program some 11 years ago. His name is Dr. Daniel Pipes, and he has been a formidable force, well, a force for good is the way I think of it, in the public policy arena for decades, notably through the institution that he is the president of and has been a driving force behind for most of that time. It's called the Middle East Forum. He is also an affiliate professor for the University of Haifa in Israel, the author of innumerable books, and an extraordinarily prolific contributor through his writings and columns and published analyses and interviews like this one to our understanding of particularly the challenges that we face in the Middle East and what we best be doing about them. And we're going to talk about one of the most pressing of them these days, I believe, and that is Turkey. Daniel Pipes, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome. Let's talk a bit about Turkey. You have studied this country closely. You've visited, I know, on many occasions. You've written extensively about it over the years. One of the most, I thought, compelling pieces that you've written, at least recently, on the subject is one that appeared in the National Interest in April, entitled Erdogan's Turkey is Not Coming Back. Coming back from where, and what are the implications of that, and why?
For 50 years, from 1952 to 2002, easy to remember, Turkey was a great ally of the United States. There were frictions, notably with Cyprus, but the pattern was very clear. The United States led, the Turks followed. We had a great ally. They had protection against the Soviets. Now, almost 20 years ago, that changed, and the debate over what changed went on for a number of years. I think it went on for too long. It was pretty clear that under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey was no longer an ally. They worked with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the Islamists, and so forth. That debate, I think, is now over. Is Turkey an ally or not? No, it's not an ally. The new debate is whether it's going to come back. If we are really nice to them, if we're farsighted, if we're judicious, maybe the Turks will come back. So that's a new debate. And I'm saying no, as you can tell by the title. It's not coming back. Turkey is gone. It's not an ally. Rather than look at it as in a barren moment or two, we should recognize that it's already 17, 18 years, and it's more like the Iranian government than some ally that took a misstep. There's a fundamental change that's taken place, and we need to recognize that and work with that.
One of the most important elements, I would argue, Daniel Pipes, in that kind of permanent change is what has happened to the Turkish military. Because during that wonderful, happy time you described, the Turkish military was not only a dominant factor in Turkish politics, sometimes actually running the country, but always powers behind the throne, and very closely aligned with the United States, determined to prevent the takeover by the likes of Recep Tayyip Erdogan for many years. What has happened to the Turkish military? Are they no longer a force to be reckoned with, or have they been so mutated by Erdogan that they're actually a force for continuity of this, well, anti-American direction?
The major event took place in July 2011 when Erdogan got control of the military. Until that point, the military was always looming there, as you suggested, in the background, sometimes in the foreground, the ultimate power. Cleverly, Erdogan managed to get control of the military some 9 years ago. And it is now his servant, as is proper. In basically, one wants the military to be subservient to the politicians. In this case, one had one's reservations, but it is subservient. There was the so-called planned coup in 2016, which was real, but at the same time, it appears that the politicians knew it was coming and took advantage of it. At this point, the military has no autonomy. It is very much under the control of the politicians of the party. Well, I would think of it somewhat like the Soviet military. It's a tool of the party.
And the AKP politics. Apparatus. And Daniel, talk a little bit, if you would, about one of the other dynamic forces over the years in Turkey, Fethullah Gulen's, well, cult followers, I guess one might call them. They were blamed for the so-called planned coup. They have been, it sounds to me, purged rather extensively from the police and military in which they had taken up some prominent roles. Where are we vis-a-vis the AKP and Gulen? Were they ever really that different? And have they effectively now been, Gulen is so marginalized by Erdogan that they no longer are a factor in Turkey?
Correct. The outlook of the Gulen movement and the AKP, of Gulen himself and of Erdogan, is similar. They're very compatible. They worked closely together. They had their distinctive roles.
Fair to say that they worked together to achieve the Islamization of Turkey?
Yes. Yes.
Fair to say. And then they fell out over the spoils, perhaps?
And then they fell out. Exactly. When, in the time around July 2011, the military was pushed aside, and then they fell out, and in particular in late 2013. And then even more so with the coup, alleged coup in 2016. So at that point, it was all out political war, and Erdogan has the upper hand, and he has crushed the Gulen movement in Turkey to the point that if you have a dollar bill, you are suspect of being a Gulen and acolyte, and you can be put in jail for it. So, yeah, Erdogan remains a significant intellectual and religious force. He has followers around the world, but he no longer is a power in Turkey itself.
I have been told, and I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this, Daniel, that they have seemingly continued to do business together overseas, including in the United States. Is there any evidence of that?
No, I'd say not at all. No, it's so bad that the Turkish government has abducted Gulenists from various countries, not this one, but various small countries. No, it's all at war. And they have used physical violence against them. For example, in Washington, some of the people who were attacked in Sheridan Circle were Gulenists. No, it's there's no quarter, but given.
Yeah, and probably none asked either for that matter. Let me ask you, though, about one of the things that has been prominently taking place of late with respect to Turkey, and that is what seems to be part of an agenda of expanding, if not reconstituting the Ottoman Empire exactly, expanding a kind of caliphate under Erdogan's leadership. Is that what's going on in terms of Turkey's engagement in Libya at the moment, Daniel Pipes? Or is that different from but going on at the same time as this aspiration to become the great theological leader once again of the Muslim world?
I would say they're two compatible but somewhat different goals. One would be neo-Ottoman, and that's focused particularly on the Balkans. The Balkans are distinctive because that's the area that was under Muslim control and to a certain extent became Muslim under Ottoman ages, which Libya was not, or Syria or other places. So the Balkans is where the AKP state is focused to bring back Turkish influence. In the broader Muslim world, including Libya, Syria, Malaysia, Qatar, the Turks are interested in extending their economic, their political, their religious influence to be the leader. And yes, that could point to the caliphate. It could. We're coming up in a couple of years on the centenary. Differs whether you're doing it in Christian or Muslim years, but it's coming up before too long. And it's just conceivable that on the centenary, Erdogan would call himself the caliph. But even if he doesn't, that goal of Istanbul, of Turkey being the heart of the Muslim world, the biggest, most influential, richest city, that's something slightly different from the Ottoman that helps explain Turkish activities in places like Libya.
So describe those activities, if you would, because I don't think this is getting tremendous attention on this side of the pond.
Of a sudden, half a year ago, there was an agreement between the GNA, the UN-recognized government in Libya, and the Turkish government. And between them, they created a naval passage that they claimed was all theirs. Roughly half was Turkish, half was Libyan. They ignored everybody else's claims, in particular the Greeks. And it just goes right by Crete, pays no attention to Crete and other Greek islands. And they said, okay, we've got this agreement, and we're now allies. And the Turks agreed to send soldiers, in large part Syrian mercenaries, to Libya.
They just decided they have their own rules. The generally accepted international rules don't apply. Turkey never signed on to various maritime agreements because it doesn't like the fact that Greek islands are right within a couple of kilometers of the Turkish mainland, and so they disputed. And then this led to this maritime zone that's shared between Libya and Turkey in late 2019. Nobody recognizes it. Everybody's against it. Everybody. There are no allies here at all.
And now the Turks have made a specialty of drones, and they're quite good at it. And it appears that it's their drones that have shifted the balance in the civil war in Libya. And Khalifa Haftar, the head of the LNA, the other side, GNA and LNA, has been losing in the last few weeks. And that has prompted his main backer, namely Putin, to send some very capable, high-tech instruments of war, particularly aircraft, to Libya. And that just happened in the last couple of days. So what we're seeing is a replication of the Russian-Turkish tensions and hostilities that have been going on in Syria for 5 years, now also in Libya.
We'll be right back with more with Daniel Pipes right after this. Daniel Pipes, again, thank you for giving us even more generously of your time. I'm anxious to get further sort of situational awareness, if I could call it that, about the relationship between Vladimir Putin and Recep Tayyip Erdogan. This is obviously a function of interactions in a whole variety of places and ways. You've mentioned Syria, you've mentioned Libya. There's the Black Sea as well, that obviously is of mutual concern and interest. And then there's the whole question of sort of Islamist forces with which Turkey, as you've mentioned, is very actively engaged, and concerns that Putin has about such forces in his own country. Could you just give us sort of a general appreciation of how they see each other and the nature of the relationship between the two?
Well, the relationship goes back a long way to the late 1500s and was generally adversarial, and generally the Russians prevailed. There were lots of wars between the two empires, Russian and Ottoman, and time and again the Russians prevailed. This is the background. The closer background is the Soviet Union and Turkey joining NATO as a protection against the Soviets. In recent years, it's more complex in that Putin and Erdogan are somewhat akin. They are similar kind of authoritarian figures. They have common opponents, as in Western Europe and the United States. They have shared interests in controlling their general territory, but there are all sorts of problems. They're on different sides in Syria. They're on different sides in Libya. You mentioned the Black Sea. For example, the Russians want easy access through the Dardanelles. The Turks would like to constrict that. They work together on oil and gas. They also compete. So it's a very complex
There's also been weapon sales that have been fractious issues between the United States and NATO and the Turks. Yeah, the S-400s.
The S-400s is the symbol of it. The Turks broke with their NATO alliance and bought this major Russian system, but they haven't really started to use it. because the threats coming from the Trump administration have been quite acute. So they're sort of in the box. They've turned on a couple of minor systems, but they're not using it.
Do you think, Daniel Pipes, that this could come to blows in places like Libya, or for that matter, I guess, Syria?
I think both sides were reluctant to have Turkish and Russian soldiers face off against each other, but they're not so reluctant to use proxies. Their proxies are fighting each other. They themselves are not at blows, and I think would be unlikely. They have too much to lose to actually fight each other.
And just in general terms, would it be fair to say that Putin is clearly the dominant figure in this relationship, and Erdogan has found it necessary on occasion at least to, well, appease or
yes,
at least accommodate?
No question. The Turks shot down a Russian warplane a few years ago, and in a unique act of submission, Erdogan apologized and made it clear that he had to go to Putin for acceptance. And more recently, there was an amusing video of Erdogan waiting for Putin to receive him in the Kremlin, and some Russian not only posted this video, but also posted the seconds going by and showing Erdogan being annoyed as he's cooling his heels and, sitting and standing and so forth. So little humiliations as well as big ones are part of the relationship. It's not an easy one, and it goes back, 4 centuries.
Not a long time. Daniel, let me turn to the question that I know you've given a lot of thought to, which is something that goes back to what you said at the outset. Turkey is an ally no more. We did a book at the Center for Security Policy on the subject a couple of years ago, and I know you've written extensively on it. What should we be doing to adjust its status in NATO and otherwise?
Well, the most drastic step is to expel Turkey from NATO. NATO itself doesn't, in its bylaws, doesn't have any provision for that. But there is the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties that allows a unanimous vote to expel a signatory. It's unlikely, it's difficult, it's the ultimate step, but I think it's something that we should aim for.
Unanimous would be, of course, other than the party in question, the Turks, who would not vote for such a deal.
I don't think the U.S. government at this point is ready to do that, but it's something to keep in mind. Something we can do on our own is to remove our troops from Turkey. We can remove our nuclear weapons from Incirlik, the major NATO base in Turkey. We can add Turkey to the CATSA, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, because of the purchase of this S-400 missile system. We can disengage economically, for example, by prohibiting the purchase of Turkish sovereign debt, excluding Turkish energy companies, and issuing anti-dumping duties on steel.
When you say excluding them from our market, is that what you have in mind? The Turkish oil companies? Okay. So this would be very heavy-duty interference with the Turkish economy. And in fact, back when Donald Trump was trying to extract Pastor Brunson from a Turkish prison and was being buffeted by Erdogan's resistance, he used some of these draconian measures, as I recall, particularly steel tariffs, to bring him around. And it did work. Do you think that it would, again, in this circumstance, given that something as big as really an alliance relationship is on the line?
I have no question that it would work. The Turkish economy is in pretty bad shape. The foreign reserves have gone way down. Foreign investment is way down. Obviously, the coronavirus has created its own problems. Turkey is vulnerable, and I think threats of economic and other measures would have a real impact on Erdogan and his policies.
Well, this is a very important basis upon which we might rethink how we have been, essentially to this point, trying endlessly to accommodate Erdogan, and it's not worked out very well at all. Let me ask you very quickly in closing, Daniel, the relationship between Turkey and Iran is another topic that probably we need more time to deal with in detail. But just quickly, is it also, as with the Putin-Erdogan relationship, a very, well, multifaceted as well as dynamic thing?
Exactly. It also goes back centuries. It also has a lot of warfare. It also has cooperation. And these days, both governments are Islamist in outlook. both seek to be leaders of the Muslim world. One is Sunni, one is Shi'i. They do cooperate on various practical levels, but they do in the end stand in rivalry with each other. So it's a complex, as with Russia, it's a complex matter of cooperation and rivalry. The tougher we are, the more they tend to work together. The more lax we are, the more they tend to compete.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, neither is in a position at the moment to be terribly much help to the other, certainly economically. Is that right?
They're both in economic trouble, and they're both are somewhat insular and not looking across the border much. Yes, they are. Their relations are weaker than they were a year ago.
No, but they're both problems for us, that's for sure. Daniel Pipes, again, I thank you so much for your time today, as well as the clarity with which you approach so many of these issues and have for decades. It's highly appreciated as well as admirable, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.